and welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm your host, Boris Felgedreher, and today I invited two prominent journalists back onto the show who cover the exciting fields of logistics, supply chain, logtech, and e-commerce. Emma Cosgrove writes about logistics with a focus on e-commerce for Business Insider, and Eric Johnson is senior editor for technology at the Journal of Commerce, where he leads coverage and analysis of technology's impact on global logistics and trade. I wanted to know what stories from the recent weeks and months they thought were the most interesting and deserved to be discussed here in more detail. So we ended up diving into the impact that the economic downturn is having on the logtech startup ecosystem, the appointment of Amazon executive Dave Clark to the role of CEO at Flexport, and we also talk quite a bit about how journalists like Emma and Eric go about their jobs covering the industry, and what you, the audience, can do to show up on their radar and get a chance of getting coverage. So there's some real actionable advice here as well that I hope you will find useful. Before we get started, a quick thanks to our supporters Grey Orange. Grey Orange automates warehouse operations through a combination of AI software and autonomous mobile robots. Grey Orange systems are in place at some very prominent companies such as IKEA or the Danish household goods and furniture retailer Jysk. If you're looking to get your warehouse and fulfillment operations to the next level with the help of autonomous robots and automation, you should definitely have Grey Orange on your list. Check them out at greyorange.com. All right, and now let's move on to the show with Emma Cosgrove and Eric Johnson. Enjoy. Hello, Emma. Hello, Eric. Welcome to the Logistics Tribe. Thanks for being on the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to be back, Boris. Thanks for having me back.
You're right. You're back. Both of you have been on the show before. So yeah, indeed, welcome back. Few people have been on the podcast twice. So what a great honor for you to be on the show again. Fantastic. And even better that you're making it work, because we just figured out that we're calling in from three different continents. Emma is in Manhattan. Eric is currently traveling in India, calling in from Delhi. And I'm calling in from the undisclosed location somewhere in the boonies from Germany. So we've got it all covered. Fantastic. Like I said in my short introduction just prior to when we started, I want to talk to you today about a couple of interesting stories that you guys have come across from the world of logistics, supply chain, and particular logtech, because that's your forte, that those are your areas. So I'm super curious to hear what we can discuss today in terms of the stories that you find appealing and interesting, or maybe undervalued. But before we get started, I'd like to ask you about something different, a different angle, which is I would love to hear more and learn more about how you guys, who've been in the business and writing about logistics and logtech space and e-commerce for quite a while, how do you go about writing stories? How do you come up with ideas? How do you research? How do you tap people for interviews? Do you talk to startup founders directly? Do you have your pool of people that you pool? Do you talk to agencies that are in between? All of that stuff. Let's start with you, maybe, Eric. You've been around the block a few times. You've seen it all from, you know, press releases that say nothing and go nowhere to real juicy stories that you've dug up. Fill us in on how your daily work as a journalist in that space looks like nowadays.
Yeah, Boris, good question. We, you know, part of you don't often get asked about how you sort of like structure your day and how you do your job as a journalist. So I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah. And hopefully this is helpful to everyone out there.
I think so. I think this should be insightful. I think a lot of people are just in the dark on how this works and how this whole thing works. I think there's a lot of people in the audience who would love to get their stories into the news, into the press, and they don't know how to do it. Maybe they have great stories, but don't know how to make them come to life. So anything you can share that makes life easier for them and for you would be helpful.
Yeah, I would agree. Actually, I've been asked this a little bit more than usual over the last few months, and I guess there is some curiosity about how this all works. I would say of all the things you mentioned, it's sort of an all of the above scenario, right? Like I think as someone who's been writing about logistics or supply chain or technology or some combination of those for almost 20 years now, there's times where the news is a little slower in coming. And then there's times like the last 2 years where it's literally like, make it stop. I need to sleep tonight. But that said, you know, you have to be, as a journalist, you have to be attuned to all the different channels of story ideas that are out there, because you don't want to miss the one that ends up being something that is really meaningful to you and your audience, just because it's not the normal way that you sort of generate stories. So I think ideally the stories generate from having conversation with a wide range of your sources, both new, old, ones that your colleagues may turn you on to, ones that someone you know may have turned you on to. And a story germinates that sort of catches a trend that you're seeing across all those conversations, right? That's probably like the purest form of what we do in terms of like trade publication journalism. Not all stories develop that way. Some are via press release. Sometimes it's an agency that I know really well. They know how I work. I know how they, who their clients are. And they tell me, hey, Eric, I know you cover this a lot. I have an interesting angle that one of my clients is working on, right? So that's a very strong way to get in front of me and get my attention and tick a box that that's meaningful for me. To me, is the agency knows what's important to me and my audience, and the founder or the company trusts the agency to sort of like be that conduit. A lot of founders just reach out directly to me. Like we're in a world where you can reach out to me on LinkedIn, on Twitter, WhatsApp, SMS, text, email, through the website. And I mean, there's a million different ways, right? So there's the layers in between getting in touch with me are not just like finding my phone number. It's you can get in touch with me a million ways. And in tech, that's often a way that I learn about new companies, learn about trends, is a ton of DM conversations on Twitter, a ton of messages on LinkedIn. So it's really like everything, all of the above. I would say the one thing to not do is just walk in and say, with really kind of tired language about transformation and digitization and whatever buzzword of the day is, and say you're an AI and ML, and say my company is doing all of these things and more for the biggest companies in the world. It's like, well, okay, I've never heard of you, so how are you doing all of these amazing things if I've never even heard the name before, right? So think, you know, see how I write, see who my audience is, understand that, and then work with me and realize it's a process. We're not going to talk today and have a cover story in the JOC tomorrow. That's just not how it works. So it's a process for me to get to know them too.
Yeah. And just back to that story around agencies versus direct contact. There's no preference I sense from you. I mean, both ways work for you.
There's founders who are terrible at explaining themselves to me and would be better suited to have someone be like that layer in between
to package it up.
And then there's founders who are amazing and tell me all sorts of interesting things about their company, about the industry, and then on the flip side, there's amazing agencies that totally get this industry inside and out, and they're not going to waste my time. And then there's ones that just message me every single day to talk to their client. I had one, sorry, Emma, I'm not letting you jump in here, but I had one company's agency message me 30 straight working days. And finally I said, and I didn't think they were that applicable to me, what I cover. Mm-hmm. So I finally said, hey, let's have a briefing. And literally they got back to me like an hour later and said, you know, I think actually our client doesn't think we're the right audience. You're the right audience for them. It's like, well, you probably could have determined that 29 emails ago, but thanks for your time. So yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit of basic research. You don't have to like dig deep to understand how I work and who the audience of the JOC is. Just do a little basic research. You'll have a general idea about like whether something's going to be interesting to me or not. Right. So.
Yeah. Do you see any difference between working with LogTech startup founders versus the traditional logistics that you also cover? Is there different in approach? Is it different generations or no difference at all?
The LogTech founders, I actually wrote a Substack on this a while back. The LogTech founders tend to be a little more savvy about how important the importance of creating buzz early on in their progression as they build their company. You know, a forwarder, small forwarder, mid-sized forwarder somewhere in a suburb of the US, it's probably not thinking about guerrilla marketing the same way that a VC-backed company that has to grow by a certain amount in a certain period of time does. So it's just a little bit more innate. I'm not sure which is ultimately better, right? Like you can burn an audience out by over-marketing yourself.
Sure.
But it's probably better to overmarket yourself than to undermarket yourself.
So. I mean, I'm quite sure which is better for me personally. Let me jump in because
mm-hmm. yes, please.
is a simpler process. Usually, most of the time, there are fewer barriers to entry. Fewer people need to sign off. It takes a lot less time to get what I need to write a story. Whereas working with a massive multinational corporation, they just move slower. That will be a surprise to absolutely no one, but the ones I think sometimes that I get frustration from big companies because I maybe don't feature their new efforts as much. And a lot of it is because they are not really willing to give sharp analysis. They're not really willing to compare to competitors. They're just very polished and corporate, and that's their prerogative. I'm not judging them for that, but it does make the coverage less interesting, and it makes the stories more difficult to turn around at the pace that I need to turn them. If that makes sense.
That actually nicely dovetails with the experience that I've had with interviewing people for my podcast, which is I quite enjoy talking to startup founders because there is a certain sense of, I don't want to call it naivete, but like some openness, some freshness, some, they're not as polished, they're more open, they're willing to just talk openly. And it takes a while until they mature and sort of a few things get taken off the table and they surround themselves with more corporate communications, and all of a sudden stuff becomes a lot slicker and a lot more polished and a lot more sort of regulated, I feel.
Life is also easier when you don't have a stock price to worry about.
Correct. That's right. Yeah, so some of my conversations, the freshest and most inspiring conversations have been with startup founders that are in a stage where they're talking very, very freely without being hindered and held back by a team of folks in the background. So those are refreshing times. And anything else to add? I mean, you've heard what Eric said. Is there anything that strikes you as odd, or would you agree with what he said, the way he works, or anything, any way that you work that departs from how Eric approaches things?
I think we have a lot in common. I'll point out that I would call the Journal of Commerce a trade publication, and that it's B2B industry facing. I used to work for a trade publication as well called Supply Chain Dive. That was 2 years ago. And I worked there for almost 3 years that's my 5 years, covering supply chain. But now I work for Business Insider, which is a more mainstream publication with a more generalist investor audience. Especially behind the paywall, which is where I write most of the time. And that means that I am looking for, we're not a paper, the term in the industry is like a paper of record. Like I don't cover every big deal. I might skip it entirely because I can't add anything special. It will be covered to death everywhere. A lot of times I pass on that big news, which hurts my soul a little bit, but I've learned to really love it because it means that I'm focusing on the stories that I can deliver unique value to, that are mine, that are based on independent reporting and that literally no one else will have. So that could be analysis, or it could be a straight old fashioned scoop. And that is my focus. I think that's an important distinction from mainstream press, if that's what you're looking for, even like Bloomberg or The Times, even they're doing more logistics coverage, and trade press, in that I don't, my job is to bring to the surface what is most interesting, what's the most, like a really great story, a really great human story in the logistics industry is always something I'm looking for, a scoop that is gonna raise the bar of our publication and make you aware of it. That's my focus. And so there are tons of really interesting technologies, interesting initiatives, out there in logistics that I pass on every day because I just don't feel like I can give them that unique quality that's going to drive you to Business Insider when Eric is going to cover a funding round or a merger like perfectly well with lovely, wonderful analysis. So that's always my goal. And also because I work in a mainstream publication, I'll add that my inbox is a crime scene. It is... Prime Day in the United States. I don't know if that's a global initiative, but it is Amazon Prime Week or whatever. And
it's global. Yeah,
which is about Prime products in the beauty category. Just because my email extension is at insider.com, it means I get a flood of general garbage. So it is hard to reach me. This I know, I'm working on it, but it just means that reaching me off channel, off of email, is usually a better way to go about it. And then I'll also say that, and I'm sure Eric feels this way too, I'm excited to speak to people who can speak to me about more than one thing and are willing to do so. It's just efficient work. So if you are currently a startup founder, but you used to work at DHL, let's talk about DHL and your startup. That's something that, you know, the first thing I do when someone introduces themselves to me is I look at their background and see, you know, what do they know? So, Eric gave an example of when a PR company, he said, okay, let's do a briefing, and they didn't have the client. Like, they didn't have the client committed to talking to him. That happens all the time. And it also means that, like, before I even talk to a company, I'm often going to be like, hey, can we talk about this, this, and this, to make the conversation more efficient. And if some of that needs to be, on background or off the record, just because I'm constantly looking to intake as much about this industry as I possibly can, even if it's not for a story today, it might be for a story 6 weeks from now. So I'd say, like, bring your whole person to your pitch, whether it's personal or through a PR company. PR people can explain your background and that you're willing to talk about it. I think that would be a big plus. That's what I'm looking for.
I'd like to co-sign the whole, like, time efficiency thing. I think part of the description is we want to talk to as many people as possible, but there's 8 hours in the day. Let's be honest, 10, 11 hours in the day. We have to write also. We're also just like every other company in the world. We have too many meetings every day. You know, there's other things in our life that sometimes crop up. So that time efficiency is a big thing. And I think the issue that people tend to have with journalism, with a big J, like, it, as an industry, is we don't get it perfectly right. We, you know, we're biased, we're this, that, and the other thing. I will tell you, almost every single issue that arises from every legitimate publication that I've been a part of, or that I know other people who've been a part of, is just time. It's time crunch. The time between getting the information, synthesizing it, making sense of it, writing it a way that means something to your audience, and then publishing it, is shrinks every single day. And so it's really a time issue. So I would say that's the big thing, is be mindful of time. Be mindful of, like, if you're making an announcement, give the reporter as much time as possible to, like, get some brain power about it. Because if you drop it an hour before it goes out and you want coverage, I'm probably booked into 8 other things that day, right? And I'll get to it maybe a week later, right? So it's not a slight on that news, and it doesn't mean that I hate that company. It's just everybody is insanely busy right now. So
makes sense. Awesome. That was a nice little detour. I kind of sort of squeezed that in before the actual conversation around stories. Let's start with those. Eric, maybe you start off. Give us one story that you feel was either, you know, so important for the industry that needs to be double clicked on and discussed and explored further in this conversation, or something maybe that was undervalued, flew under the radar, and deserves a second look, so to speak. Where do you want to start? What's one of the stories that you want to surface?
I think probably the one, I mean, I'm not going to win a Pulitzer for this, I don't think. Probably like probably a zero chance of it. But I think it's one that's super important right now, is sort of taking stock of the temperature of the funding environment and what how that's translating into the logistics technology world.
Yes.
It's one of those things where it's like every single conversation I have these days circles back to that issue at some point. Maybe it starts with it, maybe it's the majority of it, or maybe it's like the last question I get to, but everybody has an opinion on this right now. And I sort of think it's a bit, and rightly so, it sort of mirrors how confusing and cross-directional the signals in the greater economy are right now. Like you can go on any news information feed or wherever you get your information, you can find two diametrically opposed viewpoints of which way the economy is right now. Like we're either, you know, I tweeted earlier today, it feels to some people like we're 5 minutes away from like Lord of the Flies territory. And other people are like, this is weird. There's 1.9 job openings for every person who's looking for a job, and like freight volumes are high, and every software company tells us that Emma probably can agree, tells us they're growing 250% year on year. And so there's these really weird signals that our brains are not processing properly. I think that's the same thing inside of the funding environment too, is we're still seeing lots of deals go down, and some of them pretty big. Sometimes we're seeing companies lay off people proactively, reactively. Sometimes those two things happen at the same time. Emma wrote, she broke the story about Stord laying off people like 3 weeks after they raised 200 or 120 in some form of debt and equity, right? So that's a, like, I rightly so, whatever their motivations, and I think they probably had decent motivations for what they're doing, but those are confusing signals to the market, much less the employees, right? So
they are, but I think, Eric, what we're unfortunately we're entering a stage where nuance is required, which is not really something that social media platforms and even media organizations are great at. Humans, I think, are really not great at nuance. And my headline on that Stord story was pitched as, you know, however many months after raising so much money, Stord laid off this many people. And part of the reason for that was because the employees were told internally that this money is going to get us through whatever's coming next. But I think, and that is the human side of that is heartbreaking and really disappointing for the people that I talked to within that company. And for anyone who's tiring of layoff stories, please remember that when there's always a person, you're talking to a person who just got laid off. If that were you, you would want it to get press. It's relatable, I would hope. But I also think that funding rounds are coming with directives. And I can't say this specifically about Stord. I don't have that confirmed. But I'm just saying that out there, I'm hearing that funders are taking a closer look, as I'm sure Eric can confirm, but also they have stipulations. They want to see either cost cuts or they want less spending in certain areas. So though layoffs and funding seem mismatched, I think that that's going to be a more common story as we go through the next couple quarters. And I'll also add that there's a lag in the data here. You never know how long these rounds have been in the works when they're being announced. And so even though it's July, I don't think we'll really understand what the funding environment is until the fall, based on how long deals can take.
No, totally right. There is a lag, and especially in the period, sort of the quarter right after things turned after the Ukraine, you know, invasion of Ukraine, there was definitely a sense that companies were announcing during that quarter to show sort of a sign of strength, right? Like, oh, even as the market's tanking, we've gotten this round when it was actually signed, you know, the funds transferred in January, right? But they're announcing it in April. So yeah, that lag is going to play itself out, I think, over the next few months. And I think everybody is very cognizant that, like, you have to be more efficient with the money that you're getting. But the thing that I wrote well after Emma's story was that there's still big rounds being signed, and some of them are happening post March, because there's still a lot of cash out there, right? And that cash is not as easy to attain, but it still needs to be deployed. It can't, you know, if the venture capital firms' own investors are not pulling that cash off the table, they want to see it invested. They don't want to see it in a bank account earning, well, now it might be earning 1.5% instead of 0.5%, but it's not enough, right? Like they invested in that model or that vehicle for a particular reason. So yeah, I think I wrote something about, you know, a flight to quality. I've had a couple VCs reach out after that came out and said, that's exactly the way we're looking at it, is like fewer bets, more, maybe even doubling up on a company that we feel really strongly about that we already invested in. So it's definitely a big change from 21. That's for sure.
Massive change. Yeah. Also,
I'm happy, by the way, because I'm writing less funding stories because those were just getting really out of hand. So sorry.
Yeah, I am too. The other thing I just wanted to add is it's important to look at where, if there are layoffs, to look at where they're coming from. My colleagues at Business Insider did a great story about how a lot of these layoffs are hitting what now seem like bloated recruiting teams, whereas in 2021, recruiters could have their pick. You know, there will not be as much hiring this year, and you're simply not going to keep your 15-person recruiting team in a year where you're probably going to end up flat. Digging into those layoffs, I mean, if it's core folks, if it's sales, you know, those are, layoffs are an indicator, but yeah, they require nuance.
I'll add one other thing about roles. I had someone fairly early on in this, when things flipped, they said, the layoffs are not going to come from engineers. right? Engineers are the ones that can have their, generally good ones especially, are have their pick of jobs in almost any market. There's still a lot of cash, right? So it's going to be those roles that are deemed a little bit more replaceable, because an engineer is not as easy to is easily yeah. replaced.
Software engineers are the last ones to go. I mean, unless the whole thing goes down, then of course there's no hope there. And I think we are going to see more startups not just make it, right? I mean, it was a long period of time where you could just get funding and sort of survive for several years without any good ideas, without any market traction, sort of hide in between the pack. I think those times are over. I think this is really sort of a reckoning. And like you guys mentioned, where, you know, it's sort of investing in quality and it's sort of a weeding out of the stuff that really, really works and has proven itself, and other stuff will just go under. I mean, I think it's, but what do you guys make of the idea or the notion that the LogTech space will be the safe haven and sort of the space inside of tech that's spared from some of the worst bloodshed? Because if anything, we've learned in the last 2 years, 3 years, is that there's such a big demand for supply chain tech and log tech, you know, such chaos, and there's just so many analog manual stuff still in deployment that the technology investments have to be made. So is that a reasonable thing? Can you identify with that position, or is that wishful thinking that the log tech space will be the only safe space, so to speak?
I was going to call it naive, but wishful thinking might mm-hmm. be correct. yeah. I think if you feel that statement in your heart, then you are maybe in denial about there being bad log tech. There's plenty mm-hmm. of bad, useless log tech out there, just because it's targeting a sector that still desperately needs modernization doesn't mean it's any good. So there's also, I mean, I'm coming across a few companies as I try and figure out, you know, which sinking ships to cover, that don't have the, you know, this is no secret, but they don't have the tech they said they had. You know, a lot of startups sort of start out with less tech than they intend to have in the end, and then they develop it as they go. That isn't going to work in this scenario. So yeah, I mean, I think that funding will keep coming into the sector in a reasonable, rational way, which I'm still seeing. But I don't think we're safe from the implosions that everyone is seeing. The cliffs are less steep, I would say, because the consumer tech side is much more susceptible to these massive drops in revenue based on sort of trends in markets. So I think log tech is less likely, you know, if your revenue was tiny, it's probably still tiny, but it's not going to disappear entirely. But yeah, in terms of the lifetime of a startup, if it's bad tech, it's bad tech.
Yeah, I've also talked to a lot of log tech startups who, over their evolution, eventually reached a point where they had to hire people from the industry. So sort of people that worked in freight forwarding for a long time, that expertise is needed. I wonder if some folks that have been in the traditional logistics industry, have worked there for many, many years, are sort of spooked now and less prone, less willing to jump into a startup situation because of the inherent risks that are rising now. And it's getting more and more difficult for these young startups that do need logistics personnel and expertise to grow. I wonder if that's a thing. Do you see that happening? Eric, what do you think?
I don't think it's any harder now than it was before. And I say that because this is not a tech only implosion kind of situation. It's, you know, there's signs across the market that we may be entering whatever you want to call it, a recession or a softening of demand. Inflation is high. Potentially freight volumes are coming down in the fourth quarter. So the forwarder, the 20-year vet at forwarder may not have their pick of jobs as they would in like a flush market. And so if there's an opportunity to join a startup that sounds interesting and is paying pretty decently and will really value your expertise, because you're literally the only one who's done this on their team, I still think there's going to be people in, you know, veterans who want a different type of challenge. And I don't think that necessarily fundamentally changes just because the market is a little bit different, but I don't know. I think it's very much case by case. It would be interesting to see like data about like how much matriculation there is from, you know, incumbent type roles into startups. There must have been a lot over the last 2 years just based on all the cash and all the hiring, and how much of that will go back to incumbents, how much of that will stay with those veterans kind of moving from one startup to another, seeing a lot of that, honestly, actually the last few months, more than bouncing back to a, you know, kind of an incumbent existing type of role.
Yeah, I talk to recruiters a fair bit about this, Boris, actually, because I'm always out there looking for a crazy signing bonus that I can write about, and no one's been willing to go on the record yet. Enough, they don't want to share their crazy signing bonuses. But that was something I was hearing from recruiters a lot last year, was that folks at incumbents are looking for a lifestyle change. They want that fast-moving, less red tape sort of environment. Conveniently, that was coupled with some of the best deals, you know, that I think the folks in this industry are going to see for a while. I think if you're an individual in logistics that's inclined to work for a startup, which is not everyone by any means, then you're looking at the deal in front of you. And that deal is probably, if you're not an engineer, not going to be as good today as it was a year ago. And you might also be focused more on direct compensation rather than equity right now. At least I would hope that that's what you're focused on. For a new opportunity. But I think folks who are inclined are still going to do that because there is still just a huge black and white difference between working at a massive forwarder and working at a startup with less than 100 people. It's just a very different life.
Yeah.
Boris, can I circle back on the whether LogTech is a little bit insulated from... So I may disagree a little bit with Emma. I don't think we drastically disagree, but I think there's a couple things that work in the log tech industry's favor right now. One of them is that the like things in crypto and fintech and consumer tech and health tech, very few companies in log tech were getting those crazy, crazy thousand time multiple valuations and funding rounds, right? So there is a smaller hill to descend off of than in some of those other industries that were wildly overvalued. Some of them even B2B. It wasn't just all consumer stuff, right? So that's one thing that I think right now, it was a struggle last year. Why is no log tech company, $100 billion valuation, right? It's probably a positive now because, yeah, no log tech was even close to that. So there's less far to fall. The second thing is a lot of the companies that I think have a bit of a tough road ahead of them are suppliers to other software companies. So if you are selling your technology to another set of less than 5-year-old software companies that are struggling right now with the funding environment and have seen their valuation slash and are not going to IPO like they thought they were and are having to cut staff, that hurts your business. If you are a supplier of LogTech software to a forwarder or a shipper that is moving physical goods, and those goods, the volumes are virtually the same this year as they were last year, you have a bit of continuity in terms of like the stability of that market. So those would be the only two things. Now, what Emma said is right. The tide is going to go out and there's going to be a bunch of companies that sort of rode the crest. There's also a lot of like duplicate companies. There were 5, 6, 7 versions of the same type of idea that came up over the last year or two. Not all of those are going to keep going. And if, you know, last year the thought was, oh, well, all of these are going to keep going and then they'll consolidate or get picked off. And some of them are now not going to make it. Right. So that would be the only things I'd add about
that. Yeah.
That consolidation is really interesting too, just because I'm really eager to see, I'm assuming there are going to be a lot of acquihires coming up in the next couple of years, just as the tide goes out. And where is the value in these startups that aren't going to make it is fascinating. Like, are the people worth an acquisition? Is the tech worth an acquisition? Even a very, very, you know, fire sale one. I love seeing that stuff. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. All right, let's transition to another story, another angle. Emma, maybe this time from your end, what else have you been watching, been fascinated by lately in terms of stories?
Yeah, I selfishly brought one of my own, but it was with friends. The Dave Clark of it all. Dave Clark, former consumer CEO of Amazon, is going to be CEO of Flexport. I think that will be news to no one listening to this podcast, but the implications and ramifications of that are fascinating to me on both sides. Had a story looking at looking at Dave's record at Amazon. He is a notorious, he's a builder. He likes to build big and build fast. That's the story of his tenure at Amazon, and he's responsible for the sort of physical shape of that company today, which is considerable and undeniable. Heading into a company that doesn't have physical assets as of yet is a fascinating transition, and just sort of temperamentally, he's known as quite demanding, quite hard-nosed, but very smart. So I'm so excited to see. I love just like, this is a great thing for me personally to be able to get this story to tell for months and years ahead. And then back at Amazon as well, Doug Harrington is his replacement, who is perhaps a polar opposite. He's a retailer at heart, cares a lot about product and merchandising and customer retention and share of wallet, which was not Dave Clark's focus based on the insiders that myself and my colleagues have talked to. So both sides of that big shift are going to be fascinating to watch. But I'm also really eager to hear both of your thoughts on the Dave Clark move to Flexport, because I talk to Amazon folks about it all the time, but I haven't talked to that many industry folks about it.
I think it's a killer move. I was surprised, though. I thought that Ryan Peterson would stick on for much longer. And then the first question that popped into my head around this was, well, obviously, it's a great validation for Flexport, one. But the question I immediately had was, well, is this a story of a natural progression that most founders go through? They're great founders. They're great at getting something off the ground. But later, as the organization becomes bigger, you need a different set of expertise that really, you know, you find in the founders, right? So you have to bring on somebody else on board that can scale a large organization that has the skills, like a guy from Amazon. Or is there more to the story? Is there some bigger things going on behind the scenes, some problems maybe at Flexport that prompted the whole thing and sort of expedited it? So it's hard to say from the outside. I mean, I don't have any insights. I have better insights into what's going on in the company, but Eric, maybe you have.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Emma. I hadn't really thought of it until you were talking about, you know, your sort of excitement about covering this as a story. But I think I may be the only reporter who knows, maybe Alex at Forbes at this point does too, but feel like I may be the only reporter who like knows Flexport 10 times more better than I know Amazon, right?
Yeah, that's
right. You know, like I think Dave Clark has been a very public figure in business circles for a very long time, and he's been studied from afar, and I've never had a conversation with him. Unlike you, I haven't sort of done an analysis of his like leadership style and his building style. The flip side is completely true. Like I've written so much about Flexport. They're sort of in some ways like my white whale. So it's, yes, totally interesting from a neutral observer perspective to watch this very public, successful person join this company that's on the vanguard of like what this log tech movement has been over the past 10 years. I have no idea how it's going to work out. I have some inclination, but definitely not a consensus in my head about the reasons why it happened. I've talked to a bunch of different people that have floated different ideas about why it is that they turned to him, why he may have accepted it, and what Ryan's motivation behind it is. I can't say that any of them are more true than what Ryan and Dave have said about it themselves. I think this is, I'm very much a wait and see type of person. Like I don't have a very good crystal ball. So just don't know how it's going to play out. It seems like a great and interesting match. But beyond that, and I'll write a million things about this as it progresses, obviously, because people are so interested in it. And it is important. It's very important, right? In our little nook of the world.
Yeah, we're going to find out how important it is. But I think there's an interesting point to be made here about late stage log tech startups too. The timeline for IPO is not looking the way it was a year ago. And I think there's a lot of rethinking going on out there. What do we need to show? Like, what progress do we need to make? What is our priority now? I think a lot of folks were headed toward that, not a lot, a handful of folks who were headed toward that finish line. And it's delayed now. So got to make big moves in the meantime. I'm not saying this is what the Dave Clark move is related to. Specifically, I don't have that confirmed information at all. But I think there are a lot of startups out there that have had to really rethink their story for the next year or two based on the state of markets right now.
Yeah, and it's only been announced, right? So the transition will happen sometime in September, I believe, right? So it's going to be a transition time, and Ryan is not completely going to disappear, but he's moving to the board, so he's going to still be around. And I think at some point in the announcement, he said that he's going to work there forever until he dies, whatever. He's always going to be on board. So if I'm just paraphrasing, but I mean, he's built a phenomenal thing. When was the last time that you built a new forwarding company from scratch, particularly with a tech backbone? Quite the feat.
I think what the story that will be written, and one thing that we picked up on in our coverage of it was, both of them said in statements, because neither of them wanted to talk to me, but they said in statements that within 5 years they expected Flexport to be the, you know, the biggest name in supply chain or something to that effect. So to me, that was, you know, they've put themselves on the clock with a specific timeline. And what does that mean, right? What does that mean? Because what you just said, Boris, is so true. Like, if everyone sort of wiped their memory clean of what Flexport was to this point, and you just said, holy cow, in 9 years, they've become whatever they are, the 15th biggest forwarder from Asia to the US, which is no small feat. It's an incredible accomplishment. But if the goal was to build something that had never been built before, that does not exist in the market, that story is yet to be written, right? And so, you know, you could see Dave Clark joining as Ryan thinking he's the one to get them to that point, right? Because I don't think Ryan ever intended to build like a direct competitor of Kuehne+Nagel. And I don't think his investors invested in him and continue to invest in him and the company to create an analog to Kuehne+Nagel, right? That's just not what they set out to do. They set out to build something a lot bigger and a lot more all-encompassing.
Yeah, but I think a lot of this talk is also this bravado that comes along with the startup founder that sort of wants to rule the world. I mean, look how fragmented the market is and always has been. And yes, they've made great progress, but they're still just a small fish among many, many small fish and among many, many big fish, right? So it's not like even in a 5-year time scale, this company is going to dominate the market or catch up to the largest players in the market. But maybe I'm too pessimistic and I shouldn't be a startup founder.
I think being good at Twitter is often misconstrued for ego.
We kept honing in too much, or we may be talking too much about Ryan Peterson. But one thing I'm super fascinated about is the way he positioned himself as the person that is to be quoted and talked to and asked when anything related to supply chain. Remember that time when he was in this 60-minute helicopter hovering over Long Beach and commenting on what's going on there? Some people find inspiring and sort of impressed. Other people find it obnoxious. Anything in between. But the way he's gotten himself on the map as the person to cite and to tweet and to like his posts on stuff related to logistics supply chain, that's quite fascinating. I don't think I've ever seen anybody who's accomplished that to be sort of the quasi-spokesperson for the industry. We probably have mixed feelings about that, Emma. How do you feel about
it? I do have mixed feelings about it. I think it's a lot less complicated than people think. Journalists are on Twitter. If you want to get their attention, be smart about something they need to know about on Twitter. Yeah. A minority of journalists are also on LinkedIn. If you're super smart on, like, if I'm starting to cover a subject I've never covered before, it's very often that I will put search terms in social media sites to see who's saying things that seem smart. And if you're not saying anything publicly, but you're sitting there thinking, I'm really smart, why is no one asking me? We don't know how to find you. There's no directory. So you got to be visible. That's all I'll say.
And visible he is, for sure. Yeah. And there's so many CEOs and forwarding companies in logistics that do know their stuff, but they're just invisible. Like you said, like, who is good at Twitter? Who is good on LinkedIn of sharing their thoughts and being open and perceived as a thought leader? I don't think there's that many. There's not many good case examples. So the bar was pretty low, maybe for him. So, and he have kind of pulled it over it.
Yeah, and also say that, like, if you want a little bit of insight into a newsroom, you know, there's me. I'm a logistics reporter. I cover logistics all the time. But we also have a team of 20 business reporters who grab something new every day, who are doing the quicker hit, shorter stories that are less in depth and require less analysis. And CNN has a breaking news desk. You know, the Wall Street Journal has a breaking news desk that will occasionally pick up an M&A deal in logistics when it's after hours or whatever. So you can imagine if you are young and you're a young journalist who covers a different industry every single day, who are you going to be able to find at short notice? Ryan Peterson, he's just findable. He's easy. Yeah. He's easy to get. Like, it's not rocket science.
Well, he's easy to find, but not easy to get. Look, Eric, you didn't get him for the interview.
No, I haven't gotten him either. I haven't gotten him either. Not in a while. Right.
Eric, anything else to add in your perspective on the way that Ryan Peterson has become the quasi-spokesperson for supply chain logistics because of his omnipresence on Twitter? What's he doing well? Anything to comment on what he should be admired for?
I think he's, you know, the two rules of social media are be consistent, voluminous, and have a strong opinion. And he's all three of those things on social, right? So he's like, you're going to see his stuff one way or another if you're interested in this industry. Or like Emma said, I mean, there was a point last year where he was on 60 Minutes and this, that, and the other. And I was kind of like, you know, as a reporter, I was kind of like, if I'm a general news reporter, I might try to find someone else to speak to get a different point of view about this. But what he has done, I think, and what the marketing team at Flexport in general have done is they've essentially, to Emma's point, they've essentially made Flexport the Kleenex of logistics. And by that, I mean, you call it, at least in the States, we call, you know, a tissue to blow your nose, Kleenex. I don't call it a nose tissue or whatever it actually is called. I call it a Kleenex. And to the person who's not in the industry, they are the reference point for logistics now because of how prominent they've been out in the market. Right. Mm-hmm. Along with maybe a couple others, but they're the ones who are sort of the label on top of the big weird logistics box.
And that, by the way, may be true from a US perspective, but I don't think that is equally true for Europe. I don't think that maybe that's due to the fact that fewer people in Europe use Twitter and are not as hooked to that channel as maybe in the US. But well, it's still a journalist platform also in Europe, but not so much as
it's
it would
about
be in the US.
For us, when we say global logistics, we mean Asia to US.
That's right.
Sorry to say the quiet part out loud.
Well, I don't. Russia to Europe. I mean global logistics. Asia to Europe.
You do, Eric. Yes, I know. But like when CNN does it, they mean getting our stuff.
Of course. Yeah. My stuff. Our stuff. In the US.
Okay, then so maybe to close the circle to the question or the topic we had at the very beginning, any advice for folks out there, LogTech startup founders, as well as people in more established roles, executive roles in logistics, in the way you present yourself to the outside world, in social media in particular, to catch the attention and tell your story and show up on the radar of journalists like you, or maybe even the business and mainstream press? Any last bits of advice?
I'll go first. I guess this is advice. It's really just an ask. Humility, humanity, loosen up, talk more freely. Like one of the things, we are talking way too much about Ryan, but Ryan's also not afraid to be wrong. He is sometimes wrong, very publicly, and he will often say, I was wrong about this. Somebody corrected me. That is a very difficult thing to do. I think he gets dunked on a lot, and the fear of being wrong, the fear of saying something that you're not authorized to say, I think often gets in the way of people sharing their actual thoughts about the actual industry. So if you can find ways within your bounds and without losing your job to get around that, and if you have insights into the market to actually put them somewhere public where someone like me might be able to find them, then I am 1,000 times more likely to find them if they're findable. And also on the startup side, I just say, I am always looking for humility. If you tell me that you're going to do something that's like clearly unrealistic and impossible, I don't think you're ambitious. I think you're deluded. So like, be realistic, have some humility, tell me your human story, just talk to me like I'm another person.
Fantastic. Eric, anything to add? Any advice from your end?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first step is like, how do you get noticed? I think, Boris, is kind of what you were initially asking about is, what does it take to stand out from the crowd? Part of what Emma said, you can accomplish before you even get on the phone or on a Zoom with us, is like the tone of how you approach. The less form letter it looks like, the less buzzwords you use, fewer buzzwords you use. Jeez. I'm supposed to be a writer. the more you are talking about, hey, I know you cover this, and I am hearing from our customer base that this particular issue is a problem, and I think we address it, right? That's a way to get someone like Emma's or my attention rather than we have a platform that's transformational for the entire industry, right? So that's the way. And also, like Emma said, email is probably the least effective way. I'm way more attuned to like when people reach out directly to me on LinkedIn and Twitter or WhatsApp than I am on email. Just a fact. I don't have the volume of emails I'm sure that Emma does, but it's enough to make me like not want to use that as a generation of leads. And then once you're on the phone, just like I said before, realize that it's a relationship. You have to share a lot. If you need to give a lot to get a lot from a relationship. So don't expect me to write a glowing piece about you if you don't want to talk about real things, real, like what your actual competitors are, your revenue. I know a lot of people are not comfortable talking about that. When you are, let's talk, right? Like it's an ongoing thing and you have to have trust in me that I'm going to be responsible with the information you give me. And you can tell me a bunch of stuff off the record and I'm never going to violate that. And it's probably going to build our relationship pretty strong. If that's the type of relationship we have. So
awesome. We leave links to your profiles, to both of your profiles in the show notes. And let's see if people honor your advice and please report back to us. We also leave links, of course, to the articles that were mentioned today and quoted. So, and if people haven't gotten the subscription to the Journal of Commerce or to Business Insider, they should definitely do that. And they should also definitely check out Eric's Substack, right? That you offer for free still. Still for free? Or is already charging for it? No, it's still for free.
No, it's $1,000 per newsletter now.
Yeah, it should be.
Free. It's totally free. EricJohnson.substack.com.
Yeah, we'll leave a link in the show notes. Emma, Eric, thank you very much for being on the program today. It's very exciting. I have a feeling that you guys have to come back. I think there's a lot more stories that we had on the radar that we wanted to cover that we didn't get to cover, but we covered the stories we did in a decent depth. So thank you very much for that. Appreciate it a lot. Hope you'll be back for more. Thanks again. Until next time.
Thanks, Boris. Appreciate it.
All right. That was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Emma Cosgrove and Eric Johnson. I hope you enjoyed today's show. If so, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.